Welcome, everyone, to the Arthroscopy Association's Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Andrea Spiker from the University of Wisconsin. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Shane Noe, who was the senior author of the Arthroscopy Techniques paper titled Endoscopic Partial Proximal Hamstring Repair, which was published in the July 2023 edition of Arthroscopy Techniques. Dr. Noe is the head of the section for young adult hip surgery and co-director of the Division of Sports Medicine, as well as the Sports Medicine Fellowship at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, Illinois. He is also a repeat guest on our podcast. It's great to have you back, Shane.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So, Shane, you've been a guest on our podcast before, but for those listeners who haven't yet had the chance to listen to your previous podcast, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice?
Sure. So I am in Chicago, and I am at Rush University Medical Center, also part of Midwest Orthopedics at Rush. My practice is largely a hip arthroscopy and hip preservation practice, which is how I stumbled into the hip and hamstring area, actually, which is the subject of our conversation tonight. And I think for those hip arthroscopists out there, the hamstring is kind of in our area of interest. And I think that that's why we end up seeing a lot of hamstrings. Our partners typically refer them to us. And I do think it is a good supplement to a hip and a sports medicine practice. So I think the interesting thing about hamstring is it really allows us to, you know, have conversations and interact with our sports medicine colleagues, because hamstring injuries and hamstring tears are kind of ubiquitous in all types of sports. So if you're taking care of teams on any level, you're going to see hamstring injuries, whether it's proximal avulsions or mid-substance tears or distal avulsions. Or if you're just taking care of patients who like to water ski, or sometimes patients who have bad slip and falls or work injuries, you'll see hamstring tears. So hopefully, you know, we'll talk about the subject of this article, but we can get into more hamstring and hamstring type injuries that I see, and I'm sure that you see as well.
So that's a great segue into what we're discussing today, which is your techniques paper on endoscopic partial proximal hamstring repair. And in this techniques, you present the case of a 52-year-old patient who injured herself in pickleball and sustained a partial thickness proximal hamstring tear. So that leads to the question, what are the typical patient presentations and symptom descriptions you see with partial thickness proximal hamstring tears versus full thickness hamstring tears?
So that's a good question to start. I would say full thickness hamstring tears are hard to miss. Those are your classic, you know, water skiing on the lake in Wisconsin or in Illinois or wherever, and you've got like a, you know, someone says that it feels like that they, you know, got hit with a baseball bat in the back of their leg. They get acute pain, swelling, bruising, like it's really hard to miss. You know, and if you're water skiing, it usually happens as you're trying to get up on the skis while the boat is accelerating. And sometimes if it's accelerating too quickly, as you're trying to eccentrically load those hamstrings, you know, the boat's just always going to win. And so in that situation, it's pretty straightforward. The other scenario that we see full thickness hamstring tears, at least that I see, are usually like slip and falls, usually for older patients. Typically, I'll see this like in the wintertime, you know, when it's icy outside, you know, they'll go out and they'll slip and fall, and, you know, they'll kind of tear their hamstring off the proximal avulsion of the hamstring. This is different than the partial thickness hamstring tears. I would say that in general, the partial tears are more chronic attritional tears. Like I see a lot of runners that have these. They just complain of constant buttock pain, feel like their running tolerance has kind of decreased. And sometimes they get to the point where they just can't anymore. And then in this particular case, this is more of a kind of a partial tear from like a cutting, twisting type injury, created a partial tear, but obviously not a full thickness tear. And I do think that they do present differently, which is, you know, why I think you asked a really good question about it. And I think we are seeing more and more of these types of patients. You know, I think we just have to start to think about how to best treat them and how to recognize them and what we need to do to help them.
Yeah, I agree, Shane. That was an excellent description. I agree with everything that you said. And I see the same thing in patients that present in my practice. It is interesting with the complete hamstring tears, how they tend to get better. So patients have extreme pain initially, extreme bruising, and then oftentimes by the time they make it to clinic, their symptoms have nearly completely resolved, Whereas you're absolutely right with the partial tears, they do seem to be chronic, that gnawing, aching, you know, deep pain that they can't quite put their finger on, that just really impacts their lives.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, and as you alluded to, while their clinical symptoms from the full thickness tears may get better from like the dramatic amount of pain, swelling, and bruising that they had, I guess I would say that in most cases, a lot of these patients, while they can get back to like their daily life activities, when it comes to more athletic type activities, at least I find that they have problems with those. You know, this is obviously outside the topic of our talk, but you know, the chronic tears that we see, the chronic full thickness tears, are also things that we see in the office as well. And those are always one that are probably the most challenging to treat.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can perhaps talk a little bit about when those are encountered, whether the endoscopic techniques that you describe here could be applied to that treatment algorithm as well. But first, can you take us through your indications for surgical intervention for partial thickness proximal hamstring tear? And what kinds of conservative treatments are you trying first?
Yeah, so great questions. For me, I would say a partial thickness tear is one that I would say is less than 2 centimeters. It may involve 1, 2, or 3 tendons. I would say noticeable on MRI. I think the MRI to me is usually pretty telling in terms of like how significant they are, in terms of how large the tears are and whether or not, you know, these might be amenable to surgical repair. In some cases, if, you know, for example, like in that runner who, you know, is a distance runner and this chronic gnawing pain that just hasn't gone away, and they may get to the point where they're like, look, I can't even run anymore. Like, let alone like I used to run marathons. Like now it's like, just, it's done. You know, in that case, I think it's pretty easy to say, hey, look, you know, we, you know, and clearly these patients have tried conservative management, including therapy and NSAIDs and oftentimes injections, and they just can't get back to running. You get an MRI, you can see a pretty obvious partial thickness hamstring tear that is, you know, clearly where their pain and symptoms are. And I think those patients are a great patient to consider surgical repair. Those patients, you know, usually have nothing else wrong with them in terms of, you know, their rest of their hip and pelvis. And that is the only thing that's stopping them. And I think what I've seen is that these runners, they just can't tolerate these partial tears, even though it doesn't seem to be that, the tears don't seem to be that large on MRI. But for some reason, they're large enough that they impair their ability to do these activities. And then in terms of conservative treatments, I mean, oftentimes, you know, if they have the symptoms, I usually will get an MRI just for prognostication purposes. You know, typically we'll undergo a course of physical therapy, anti-inflammatories. I've tried injections in the past, both cortisone and PRP, and I think they work sometimes, not something that is with any level of predictability. But clearly, if they fail all those, then, you know, typically we'll offer them endoscopic repair.
And speaking of injections, you know, one of the concerns we have with intra-articular injections is potential damage to the intra-articular cartilage. And so at least in my practice, you know, I tend to be a little bit more liberal with cortisone injections or, you know, other injections around the ischial bursa when it's necessary, because I'm not as worried about cartilage. Although I do use intra-articular injections as needed, just conservatively. But what do you think about, you know, I've definitely had some responses from radiologists who worry that by injecting around the ischial bursa, we're going to cause the tendon to completely tear off of the ischium. What are your thoughts on that? And if patients ask you about that, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I think those are legitimate concerns. You know, you can approach this very similar to either rotator cuff partial thickness tears or, you know, Achilles tendonitis with partial tears in the Achilles as well. And so I think in both situations, frequent cortisone use might lead to full thickness tears. That being said, I agree with you. I don't really have a problem trying it, just in the event that it might alleviate their pain and symptoms, especially in the case where their MRI is like not that significant. Or I should say the tear is not that large, and in which case it's hard to make a case to go forward with surgery. I mean, PRP is a good alternative. You know, I think that addresses the concerns of tendon injury or tendon propagation, but also, you know, allows for the potential for healing. I haven't had anything predictable in terms of my experience with PRP for hamstring injuries, but I don't have a problem with it. I just, you know, I think it's pretty low yield, at least in my own practice.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one other thing, you know, with the concern that cortisone might complete a tear and make it full thickness, I feel that in that case, it just makes our treatment pretty obvious. Then the treatment would be to fix it. So it almost helps us in multiple ways. And I agree with you. There's really no big downside to trying it.
Yeah. And then the diagnostic component to it too is helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, would you ever consider an open takedown and repair instead of an endoscopic for this partial thickness hamstring tear?
Sure. I mean, I used to do the open takedown and repair until I started to migrate to the endoscopic. I would say the endoscopic is easier. I would say it's definitely easier to visualize. I think it's easier to perform. I think it's safer, to be honest, because I think you get a better look at the sciatic nerve. So I think for any partial tear, I would say that in my estimation, the endoscopic approach is probably, I would argue, better. Except in the case where, I mean, sometimes you'll get like a single tendon, like acute avulsion. And in that case, I would say that, you know, where it's definitely evolves with like a pretty decent, you know, let's say greater than 2 centimeter gap between its attachment to the ischium. In that case, I think you can do that open just because typically you'll be able to find that avulsed tendon. Whereas in many cases, you know, it's hard. I mean, because most of the tendon is still attached. It's hard to know how much to go through. I think in an open situation, the problem with hamstring management in general is just being cautious of the nerve and knowing where the nerve is the whole time. And I just find like with the open approach and a chronic attritional tear, it's just harder to see just because you're really trying to visualize way up into the ischium and it's not fully torn where you can start passing your sutures like outside the wound. And so you have to do it like almost like in situ. And the nerve gets awfully close. And that's my only concern about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So at this point, can you take us through your endoscopic technique, starting with positioning, portal placement, insertion of the scope and instruments? And I should mention here before you start that the video and techniques paper that you published really show this extremely clearly. So I encourage all the listeners to take a look at it online. But if you can do your best here, just telling us how you approach this surgically.
Sure, love to. So yes, the patient has to undergo general anesthesia. They're placed in a prone position. And we usually just use like, we set it up the same way that we do open. And so, and it is easy to convert from endoscopic to open. If you're just kind of getting started and you want to try it and see what it's like, you can always convert to open without much of a problem at all. You know, we used to use like a Wilson frame, but we actually went away from that. And now we just use like, you know, gel padding to just make sure we pad like the iliac crest and like the kind of anterior chest wall. And it also gives you a little bit of flexion at the hips as well to provide like better exposure. You can also, you know, jackknife the table as well. That can help too. I would definitely encourage listeners who aren't doing a lot of endoscopic repairs to use fluoroscopy because sometimes you can get lost, especially when you're starting out. You're just not used to the anatomy and so forth. But I typically actually don't even use fluoro at this point because it's pretty straightforward. And so just like if you look at the article, you can see that we've kind of prepped everything out. And then I'll have our incision will be kind of just along the gluteal crease. And typically we'll start with that inframedial portal, which will be, you know, pretty much like in line with like the midpoint of the ischium. You know, you want to make it like at the gluteal crease. So in the event that you have to convert to open, you'll just kind of follow the incision and connect your two portals, which will be your inframedial and your infralateral. And oftentimes, like, I won't even use like a spinal needle. I'll just, you know, just use my 11 blade, you know, make a portal incision, take the trocar, and just, you know, insert it to the point where you can actually feel the ischium. And once you feel the ischium, like, you know, you're pretty safe. You can kind of sweep the bursal tissue back and forth. And you just want to make sure you're underneath like the subgluteal space, or in the subgluteal space, I should say. And once you do that, like, you're, you know, it's a pretty open potential space. It's just like going into the subcoronal space. Everything really starts to open up. You can start your fluid at that point. I typically like to start at usually about 30, pump pressure of 30. And then we'll go ahead and establish that infralateral portal under spinal needle localization. And then once you can see the spinal needle, you can use either a switching stick or like a shaver. I like to use a 4.0 millimeter smooth shaver without teeth. I think that helps, just as you're, you know, doing your bursectomy, as well as when you're dissecting around the sciatic nerve. I think it's just a little bit safer. So at that point, you'll just perform your bursectomy, and the bursectomy will then allow you to, you know, completely see like the ischium. You'll see the hamstring muscle. You'll see the hamstring tendon. And then the next thing you want to do is you want to find the sciatic nerve. And the nerve is obviously really important. You just want to make sure you know where it is throughout the entire of the case. And it's hard to miss. Like, you know, you can't miss it. Once you know where the ischium is, and you can, again, use your floor to localize it, use a switching stick if you're uncomfortable using a shaver at first, palpate the ischium, and then you just want to sweep laterally. And as you go laterally, oftentimes there'll be some like bursal tissue. And in some cases, you might actually see like some of the cutaneous nerve branching off like the sciatic nerve. And obviously you want to try to preserve those as much as you can, but you can just use a switching stick to just kind of bluntly like sweep away like some of the bursal tissue until you can clearly see the sciatic nerve. You know, once you can get past that, then you feel much more at ease as far as continuing with the case, because you know where the dangers are. Some surgeons like to actually place a switching stick and just kind of put it in between the ischium and the sciatic nerve. There are other surgeons that like to abduct the leg, because that will then, you know, bring the nerve less in tension and also more lateral. So those are some strategies that might help, just to kind of get the nerve out of the way. And then at that point, with these high grade partial thickness tears, they're kind of like glute med tears or rotator cuff tears. If you're looking at it from the bursal side, you will see an area that looks like it's less competent. And so you'll just use a switching stick or the back of your shaver or your radio frequency device and just kind of palpate. And where it feels like it's kind of bilodable is where the, I guess, the entry point of where you would start to interrogate where the tear exists. Using the MRI, I think, is pretty helpful, just to understand, like, you know, is this tear like more along the conjoint tendon or the semi-T or semi-membranosus? And this will also help as you're starting to kind of recognize like which of the footprints you want to reattach and where you want to enter, you know, the common hamstring peritina. And, you know, oftentimes, like, right when you incise like that hamstring peritina, basically everything will start to open up and it'll look like a full kind of tendon avulsion, just with like that superficial layer of the peritina still intact. And then at that point, you know, what I'll do is I'll put the camera, and again, the camera is still in that inframedial portal, and go into that hamstring tendon where the avulsion exists. And that way you can clearly see the ischium. So if you're following along in the article, like figure five, you know, the camera is looking at the ischium itself and the tendon is kind of behind us. And then at that point, it's, you know, it's like doing a rotator cuff repair. You'll go ahead and use your spinal needle. And in some cases, you can place your anchor through that infralateral portal, or sometimes you might have to use a spinal needle to then put the anchor at a different angle, just percutaneously. So whatever type of anchor you're using, you'll go ahead and insert the anchor. And then at that point, you just want to pass sutures through the tendon. And so you can use a tissue penetrating device. You can use like a spectrum type of device or a suture lasso type of device, you know, whatever seems like it's most amenable. Usually the penetrator is pretty good. Oftentimes I'll use the penetrator just from that infromedial. You'll go ahead and, penetrate it through the tendon and retrieve, as you're going into the peritoneum and just kind of hugging the ischium, and then just start retrieving it out. I think one of the things to keep in mind as you're doing a lot of hamstring work is that the footprint of the hamstring actually goes much more lateral than what you think. And so it sits lateral. So you want to make sure that your anchor is not like at the tip of the ischium, but rather more lateral too. And then as you're passing your stitches, you want to make sure you reapproximate, the lateral nature of the hamstring footprint. And so, with the partial tears, I'll typically use like one triple loaded anchor or two double loaded anchors, just depending on the extent of it. I think in this article, we had mattress suture configuration, but we have a follow-up article where we started to use a different locking configuration with a running suture.
Yeah, that'd be great if you could just talk us through how you perform a locking suture configuration.
So similar to what we had just talked about. So you can start with like a mattress configuration. And so you could either just tie it right there if you feel like you've got nice tissue that you're nice tissue bites and you feel like you've got pretty substantive repair. But if you're concerned at all, what I would do is I would then either use like a scorpion type device. I think that tends to work well, like a rotator cuff, kind of grabbing and passing device, whatever it's called. We'll just call it a scorpion for now. But you can use a scorpion. And then you've got one mattress in, you can grab it again, you can pass it continuously through, you can do it up to three times if you want to. And that'll then allow you to use the same suture and run like a running stitch through it. Now, the one thing to keep in mind is that as you're passing the stitch, oftentimes the needle will start to go more lateral and inferior, which is where the nerve is. And so you do want to see where that needle is coming out to make sure that you're far away enough from the nerve that that's not going to be a problem.
And Shane, do you use a new portal with this different mattress technique or this different locking technique?
No, same portal.
Okay, great.
So just put a cannula through that infralateral portal, and typically we'll use the scorpion through that portal and just do a series of stitches. Like two or three down and like two or three up, tie that to the other stitch that has also been passed through the tendon in the initial like mattress configuration.
Well, that sounds like an excellent solution to sometimes the concern that endoscopic repairs are not as robust as open. So what a great technique that you've described. We talked a little bit briefly earlier about full thickness tears that might be treated endoscopically. Very briefly, can you tell us a little bit about what type of full thickness tear you could approach with this same technique?
Yeah. So if you're looking at the MRI, as long as the tear is within like the subgluteal space, I think it's fine to treat endoscopically, at least for me. But I know there are other surgeons that will even treat the ones that are, retracted much more distal. So they will even go past like that subgluteal crease. But, I think part of it is, if it's like an acute avulsed hamstring tear, and you get to it like within a week or two, they're obviously a lot easier to do and doing it open, like it's pretty straightforward. And so to some degree, you just, at least in my mind, like I just want to be reasonable as far as like, the risks involved, the anesthesia, the OR time. And for like an acute avulsion with like 4 to 6 to 8 centimeters of retraction, like those can be done pretty quickly and pretty efficiently open and safely as well. So at some point, I think that sometimes it's just like we're trying to do these techniques and it's technique without reason, I guess. Some people might have issue with that too.
Yeah, I agree with you. To end here, can you tell us a little bit about the rehab for this endoscopic partial thickness hamstring repair? Is it any different than, our previous full thickness open repair rehab?
It's slightly different. I would say that I typically, obviously it's outpatient surgery. I'll place patients on crutches and I'll put him in a hinged knee brace, flexed and locked at 45 degrees. And then I'll allow them to unlock and begin weight bearing at like 4 weeks. With a full thickness tear, I usually will lock them for like 6 weeks. So I will advance them a little bit quicker. But outside from that, like the rehab is essentially the same. So I'll work on getting off their brace, crutches, reestablishing a normal gait. And then one of the things I always caution the patients and the physical therapist is not to do any isolated hamstring curls. Oftentimes the patients are like, well, when can I do that? I'm like, well, I mean, really, you probably shouldn't do that for like several months or so. Like there's no real benefit to doing that, you know? And so I try to bring them along as possible and focus on like more core and pelvic strength, as well as closed chain lower leg strength, rather than like them focusing in on like trying to do hamstring curls. I don't know. Do you get those questions too from patients? Like, I want to do hamstring curls. Like, when can I do it?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about the rotator cuff, and I think going back to rotator cuff treatment and post-op rehab is important to translate here. Rotator cuffs and slings and restrict them from using the arms. And I would argue that the leg is bearing a lot more weight than the arm is. So
yeah,
we should be just as conservative, if not more conservative, with the hamstrings as we are with the rotator cuffs.
Yeah. And it's like repairing a distal bicep. And then, you know, patients asking like, when can I start curling the biceps? And you're like, well, let's kind of pump the brakes here a little bit.
Well, thank you so much, Shane. This was an excellent description of your endoscopic technique. And again, I encourage everybody to look at your techniques video and the paper, because you guys did an excellent job with your videos and photos, really helping us understand how you approach this. Just in closing, any final thoughts on this technique and, you know, the evolution of endoscopic hamstring treatment? Do you think there will continue to always be a role for open repair, or is this the way of the future?
No, I think there's always going to be a role for open. I mean, as we kind of talked about a little bit, like if it's acute, you know, greater than like 4 or 5 centimeters, I mean, those are very straightforward. They're, you know, I think they're, you know, doing an open approach makes sense. They're pretty straightforward. They're efficient. You can get them done with like pretty minimal concerns for like complications, and you get a nice, and some people would argue, a better repair, more robust suture configuration, open, and definitely I think that's the case. I think that the one parting thought that I would say is that, you know, our traditional indication for hamstring repair, either a full thickness 3-tendon tear or 2-tendon with greater than 2 centimeters, is the question that I think we got to start to think about whether or not we should change the paradigm as far as like when these hamstring tears are indicated, because I don't think it's as black and white as that anymore. And especially as we're seeing, you know, the results of like endoscopic repairs and the dysfunction and disability of patients with these chronic attritional tears, I do think that we got to start to rethink it. Similar and along the lines of rotator cuff and partial rotator cuff tears, how that also has evolved too. I think that this will evolve in a similar way.
Well, an excellent point to end on. And thank you so much again, Shane. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you again. It's an honor to be a guest on this podcast, and look forward to future podcasts.
Dr. Noh's techniques paper titled Endoscopic Partial Proximal Hamstring Repair can be found in the July 2023 issue of Arthroscopy Techniques Online. This concludes our episode of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. Thank you for joining us. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal.